Good morning. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Copenhagen briefing. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Susie Emmerling. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, Lynn. As Lynn just said, my name is Susie Emmerling, and I'm here at the Center for American Progress. And I will take any follow-up questions from you after the call. I can be reached at 202-481-8224 or semmerling, with two M's, at americanprogress.org. I'd like to welcome you to the special Copenhagen briefing with Ambassador Peterson, Daniel Weiss, and Andrew Light. We'll start by introducing Andrew Light, Senior Fellow at Center for American Progress.
Thank you, Susie. Our topic today is going to be the run-up to the UN summit next week in Copenhagen, COP15, but in particular, the recent developments that were initiated by the Danish government to propose a two-step treaty process, whereby we focus the upcoming Copenhagen meeting on getting a political or interim agreement and then work towards a fully final and ratifiable agreement over the course of 2010. With us today is Ambassador Friis Petersen, who is the Danish ambassador to the United States. And joining me is my colleague Dan Weiss, who is Director of Climate Strategy at the Center for American Progress, as well as a senior fellow here. I'm going to start with Ambassador Petersen. He will speak for a few minutes. I will pick it up from there, and then we'll go to Dan, and then open it up for questions. Ambassador.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I think it's a very important topic that we are discussing, and I think that where we are right now, it's important to understand that the Danish government, the Danish Prime Minister's two-step approach is in reality the most likely viable and feasible approach towards a comprehensive deal that can potentially be sealed in Copenhagen in a couple of weeks' time. We have been trying for the last couple of years to reach a comprehensive, legally binding deal with 192 countries on board, and we've been working on documents in the UNFCCC process, about 200 pages long document. But a couple of months ago, we had to realize that we couldn't, with any likelihood, reach a comprehensive, legally binding deal in Copenhagen. So we had to do something that would be better and a shorter road to, hopefully, an overall political agreement. And so those two steps we are hoping to take is exactly as described. The first one, the very important one, that we get a very ambitious, comprehensive political agreement on all the building blocks that we have to cover, both the shared vision, the mitigation, adaptation, finance, technology, and capacity building. So the Copenhagen Agreement should be concrete and commit countries to reach targets, to undertake actions, to provide agreed finance. And we do need numbers. So the first and most important step is really to get the political breakthrough. Is that going to happen in Copenhagen? Well, that's a very difficult question to answer right now, but we see the momentum building up the last couple of weeks in an unprecedented way that we have been hoping for. Both major partners and participants in the conference, like the U.S., China, Brazil, Korea, have come up with new numbers, very bold, courageous, but also political, realistic numbers. And we have also, secondly, seen a very, very surprisingly strong willingness to participate at the highest level in the summit in Copenhagen on the 17th and the 18th of December. We have about 98 heads of state, heads of government already signed up to participating in that meeting. They will only show up in Copenhagen because they think it's going to be a political success. They don't want to come to Copenhagen to be part in a failure. They want to be part in a political deliberation that hopefully will end up by a positive conclusion at a Copenhagen deal. So that is, I think, the momentum we are building together with many countries. I think the U.S. leadership in Congress and in the administration by the president himself has been exercised with quite a lot of vigor, and therefore also is a very, very important building block for us in this process to create this momentum to come to the Copenhagen agreement. The second step next year will, of course, have to be the one that sort of then does all the very important work in extracting from the political deal the legally binding detailed language. Hopefully that's going to be much more easy and doable with the overarching comprehensive political deal. So in conclusion, I think our approach was, given the circumstances, given the history and the evolution of the topic in different many countries, the only really realistic, pragmatic approach to getting where we want to get at this exact time, where there seems to be a sort of unique window of opportunity.
Thank you, Ambassador. From our perspective at the Center for American Progress, one thing that we've been thinking about over the course of the last year, really after the election and looking forward to this year with the inauguration of President Barack Obama and the changeover in the administration, is that we have to keep in mind that the deadline for making Copenhagen the meeting where we needed to decide what kind of agreement would succeed the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, which ends in 2012, was decided at the Bali meeting in 2007. It was part of the package, the overall package of what we now know as the Bali Action Plan. The Bali Action Plan was agreed to in a rather dramatic final closing ceremony by the Bush administration, which set the clock for 2 years to really work towards hopefully getting to Copenhagen and getting a fully final and ratifiable deal. What we have to realize is that the Bush administration then proceeded to do absolutely nothing to move along the prospects of success in Copenhagen for a year. And as a participant in the meeting last December in Poznan, after Barack Obama had already been elected, the administration continued to make sure that there was no significant progress toward success in Copenhagen at the Poznan meeting. And so really, the clock started ticking once President Obama was inaugurated. And this was an enormous lift for an administration, in fact, for the world, to move as quickly as possible towards potentially getting to Copenhagen, while, of course, the president was facing monumental hurdles in terms of fulfilling his promise to pass comprehensive health care legislation, extricating the United States from two foreign wars, and dealing with the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. This many of us thought then that it was going to be very difficult to get a final deal out of Copenhagen. But I'd like to say that I think that that through the course of the past year, I've seen an enormous amount of progress, especially not only in the formal UN negotiating process, but also in the Major Economies Forum, which coincidentally was a process that President Bush started during the waning days of his tenure. And that process brought together the 17 largest economies, including the EU, on the assumption that one way to get beyond the impasse that we see in the UN deal between developed versus developing countries was to create a forum where the major emitters, the major parties, could speak more directly towards each other. And I think a lot of progress was made in that respect as well. Now, we all would have liked to have seen a final deal come out of Copenhagen, but I think in the last few months, the most that I personally had hoped for is that at Copenhagen we might see advance on the architecture of the treaty, perhaps an agreement on particular sectors like the forestry agreements, which are looking very good at the moment. But really, we wouldn't even get to the point of talking about midterm targets or financing. And so in the last 2 weeks, what's happened has been absolutely astounding. To go from essentially the prospect of having to explain why really nothing got decided at Copenhagen, to really now, thanks to the Danes, having the possibility of this firm first step. And I think that it's important to look at this first step not only in terms of the targets that have been put on the table now by the largest emitters such as China, India, and the United States in the last couple of weeks as part of this Danish proposal, but also to see President Obama's commitment, as he expressed it in Beijing, that whatever is done in Copenhagen must take immediate operational effect. And that's absolutely critical because, and this is something my colleague Dan Weiss will speak to in just a second, for President Obama to now essentially go ahead of the process in the U.S. Congress, not to foreclose what the outcome will be in terms of the congressional deliberations, but nonetheless make a commitment that the United States will actually rejoin the world as soon as we get this first step of the process done after Copenhagen, is an enormous and significant commitment, and truly does signal the leadership that this administration is willing to take on this process. So I'll stop there and pass it over to my colleague Dan Weiss, who's going to speak to not only the ways in which we can look at the following year of negotiations in the Senate and getting a full closure on a domestic commitment on clean energy and reducing carbon pollution, but also talk about how the timing that we now have, the extra time we have because of the Danish proposal, how that does assist the domestic process.
Yeah. Thank you, Ambassador Peterson, and thank you, Andrew. This is Daniel J. Weiss, Senior Fellow and Director of Climate Strategy at Center for American Progress. There's an old saying, laws are like sausages. If you like either one, don't watch how they're made. And this saying is particularly true in the United States. As you all know, the United States system is very different from a parliamentary system where you have a legislature that generally follows the prime minister. In our system, we have checks and balances to ensure that the administration doesn't become dictatorial and that the legislature requires agreement with the president. Also, further compounding the challenges to our process is that our upper body, the United States Senate, was designed to make change more difficult to achieve. The Senate has rules that allow unlimited debate unless there are 60 votes out of 100 who are ready to end the debate. In other words, you need a supermajority of 60 votes to pass anything. Now, that didn't used to be this way. In our recent history, most filibusters, which is what this process is called, were only used for the most extraordinary issues, civil rights laws in the 50s and 60s in particular. But now the filibuster is routinely used as a tool to delay and block legislation. And in fact, last year there were more votes to end filibusters than ever before in the history of the United States Senate. Given that, it's going to take time for the U.S. Senate to assemble the 60 votes to pass comprehensive global warming legislation. Fortunately, the House of Representatives has already acted. They have different rules that makes it easier for the majority to move. Their bill would achieve a 17% reduction in greenhouse gas pollution below 2005 levels from putting a cap on emissions. In addition, there are a number of other policies that will achieve additional reductions. And so, according to at least one estimate, the House legislation would achieve about a 28% reduction in global warming pollution below 2005 levels, or about a 13 or 14% reduction below 1990 levels. In the Senate, we've begun to make some progress. Both the Senate Energy Committee and the Senate Environment Committee have already passed bills that address their different pieces of the legislation that they have jurisdiction over. These are the two building blocks that are going to be used to put together a bill that will come to the Senate floor. The challenge in the Senate is because this issue is both partisan. Most Republicans oppose any action on global warming. In fact, a number of senators in the Republican caucus don't even believe global warming is real. And also, there's regional interests. There's coal states, oil states, etc. So it's both a partisan challenge and a regional challenge to build the 60 votes. The process has been somewhat slowed down by the health care debate, which has dragged on into December when many people were hoping it would be done a month ago. But that means that the global warming debate will have to begin in the full Senate next year. We expect that a bill will come to the Senate floor probably in spring, maybe as soon as March. We can expect a lengthy floor debate. Eventually, the Senate will pass a bill, and it will likely be very different than the House bill. Then it has to go to what's called a conference committee, where leaders from the Senate and House work out the differences between the two bills. It's important to note that the bill that comes out of the Senate may be much different than the House bill, but it is not going to be what is in the final bill. Many years ago, the Clean Air Act of 1990, which is one of the strongest environmental laws ever passed, was actually weaker than existing law in some ways when it came out of the Senate, but that was fixed in this conference committee reconciliation process. So once we work out the differences between the bills, then we will send them back to both houses. They have to vote up or down on them, no changes allowed, and the president signs the bill into law. Now, some people have said that as we get closer to the 2010 congressional elections, it will be harder and harder for politicians to vote to address global warming problems. That is not consistent with history. Throughout the history of the modern environmental movement, most of the major environmental laws were actually passed into law shortly before midterm or general elections. So it would not be unprecedented for that to happen here. There's one other tool that the administration has that will keep pressure on the Senate to act. Under the Clean Air Act, the president has authority to require reductions in global warming pollutants from major sources like power plants and other industrial sources. If Congress refuses to act, then the president will use that authority to seek reductions. The president doesn't want to do this, nor do many in the Congress want to do it, because there won't be able to be a lot of the ancillary policies included that will smooth the transition to a low-carbon economy. But that is a tool to keep pressure on the Senate and get them to act in 2010. So I'd like to turn it now back over to Andrew, and I think we'll take some questions.
Lynn, we'll go to Q&A now, please.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Our first question comes from Christian Wernickel with South German Times.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call here. Chris Wernicke, Süddeutsche Zeitung of South German Times. I was especially interested in this, in the last part, about the political probability that you will be able to enact anything after the very fundamental shake-up of the political system and of society by the healthcare debate, with town hall meetings and all the kind of things that also foreign correspondents over here covered. When I talk to, let's say, former political advisors to a former Democratic White House, they are very pessimistic about the chances that Obama will really risk to go for a kind of second healthcare shake-up of his presidency. Why are you so confident that he will take that risk that might ruin his whole presidency? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. Well, first, it's important to note that the transformation from a high-carbon to a low-carbon economy is one of the central elements of President Obama's domestic agenda and a big part of the efforts to help the American economy recover. President Obama understands that the country that develops and manufactures the clean energy technologies that the world is going to want in the 21st century are going to be major economic players. So he talks about this effort at nearly every opportunity. I believe that if the healthcare process leads to successful passage of healthcare reform, which they're doing in the Senate now, and then they'll have to finish it next year, that will actually increase his political capital and his ability to move on to something else. Because I think once they complete the health care reform, that will see an improvement in his polls and will give other leaders the confidence that he can lead them through safely. It's important to note that the obituary for global warming legislation has been written almost every day since President Obama took office. Many observers have said at every stage that it's not going to pass. Before the House committee, before the House floor, now in the Senate committee, the obituaries for this bill will continue to be written every day until President Obama signs it sometime next year.
The next question, please.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Yeah, I
go ahead.
I think from a Danish perspective, it's clear that this is going to be a crucial U.S. domestic political debate. And, of course, we think that a positive outcome of the Copenhagen summit will actually present exactly the kind of breakthrough that the proponents of the U.S. climate legislation needs to convince skeptics and doubters that this is something that the rest of the world is actually going to exercise and implement for real in their economies. And no climate deal, no climate protocol can be real without very sound energy policies. And there'll be a lot of support for the energy policies that are progressive, that will make the U.S. economy much more competitive and much more internationally economically attractive. And the new green jobs that the administration is praising is something that we in Denmark, for example, as a small country, actually have practiced for a number of years. So I do think that this is a very, very attractive context for the U.S. Domestic action, that the international action will prove that there is a need for this. We can't escape this for many reasons. So there's not just the climate need to do something to prevent global warming. And even if you don't believe in that, there's also the international economic competitiveness argument and the need to save your environment. So I do believe that on top of that, there's national security interest in becoming a much more smarter energy-wise economy as well. So the overall, I think, context for the administration and for the Congress and those who want to enact in Congress is quite attractive. As a foreign observer, I can note that there's going to be, of course, a very difficult pathway ahead. The proponents will have to win the sort of political debate to have a successful passage of climate and energy bill on the green jobs. But I do think that that's real. I think that many European countries and others, the Chinese, the Indians, Brazil, very important new economic powers, are going to compete with the U.S. on exactly this kind of variables. So that there is really a very, very solid, compelling argument to be made in favor of the U.S. doing exactly this as well.
Yes, this is Dan Weiss. Ambassador Peterson makes some excellent points. One thing that's important to note is among the people in the U.S. Senate who are undecided on this issue, many of them are concerned about whether or not the United States would end up acting unilaterally with some of our major competitors like China and India not taking action. Well, we've seen in the last 2 weeks, in thanks due to leadership by Denmark and other nations through the Copenhagen process, both China and India have made announcements about reducing their level of emissions intensity over time. This is the first time these nations have ever taken any of these sorts of steps, and that will help us in the domestic debate. As Ambassador Peterson noted, that a successful outcome in Copenhagen will further help us with those members who have that concern.
Yeah, one thing here is I should go ahead and mention now is that the Center for American Progress is part of a global network that works on climate change called the Global Climate Network. It's 9 think tanks around the world with a very similar profile to the Center for American Progress. So not only involved in producing detailed legislative reports, but also involved in legislative action as well. We have partners in the UK, in Germany, in Australia, Nigeria, South Africa, China, India, and Brazil. And these include such institutions as the Wuppertal Institute in Germany and the Institute for Public Policy Research in London. We will be releasing a report probably at the end of next week on low-carbon jobs in an interconnected world. And just looking at those 9 countries and only a very select section of job creation in those 9 countries, we estimate that if everyone does what they're saying they'll do now, that you'll get the creation of 19.7 million jobs around the world through common investments in clean energy. And I think that's the kind of momentum that the ambassador may be talking about. And the question I might have actually for the ambassador is what is your sense right now of how your colleagues in the EU are approaching the the prospects of a two-step deal of the political agreement? Are you seeing by and large satisfaction with this possibility for structuring success in Copenhagen this way and then moving on through 2010, or are there concerns?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that fortunately the answer is a very positive one, that all European Union member states leaders have come to the conclusion that we need to do this, simply for all the reasons we just discussed: the need for a more efficient economy, the preservation of resources, competitiveness, but also the green jobs and the climatic effects. So it's really even in times like this, where we in Europe have the same type of very adverse economic condition, very high unemployment in some countries. I think Spain is suffering unemployment which is higher than 16%, really very dramatic, but still believing in that the only way forward to create the new so-called normal is exactly to do better on energy policies and to do what we have been doing for a long period of time in Europe, operating a European trade schedule and system that for us has been working well and really allowed us to price emissions of carbon dioxide. So we really am committed to do this, and our numbers for 2020 are pretty high. We will even increase that agreement to do the 20% reductions by 2020 by 1990 standards to 30% reduction in 2020 if we see that the other parties to the agreement in Copenhagen will do what we think is sufficiently reductions and will get a sort of level playing field that we can still compete in and make economic headways in. So for us, this is really something that we not just politically find ideologically attractive, but also economically and foreign policy very, very attractive and necessary to do. And fortunately see the courage and the wisdom in trying to make work in the best possible way. Of course, it would be very attractive for European Union to have the U.S. in on this agreement, like China, India, and all the major parties in the world economy. That's obvious. But I do think that we're also seeing that exact commitment by the administration and democratic leaders in Congress that hopefully also will allow that to be the case in the next coming year.
Thank you, Lynn. Are there any more questions at this time?
Not at this time.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank Ambassador Peterson, Andrew Light, and Daniel Weiss for participating in this call, and for all of you who dialed in today. Again, my phone number is 202-481-8224. My email address is semerling@americanprogress.org, and we have taped the audio of this call, and I can email it to anyone who's interested in listening to the conversation in full. Thank you all very much. Have a nice day.